So welcome to Anant Saxena. I hope I'm saying that correct. He's the CEO of Atomex Digital. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Hi. First of all, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. It's a pleasure to talk about the journey. It's been quite interesting, frankly. So thank you so much for having me here. A bit of, about my background, Kalyan. My background is technology, digital transformation, and change. I started as an engineer, and quite a long time back, did my engineering, and worked in a number of startups in the early part of my career. So that inkling was always there. Then joined some large digital agencies like Sapient, Razorfish, and FBA Systems. Delivered a number of large transformation programs, more digital transformation and technology-led change. Led a digital business unit, MBAE, to create the go-to-market strategy. The interesting part to me during my journey in the past 4 to 5 years has been that throughout my last 4 or 5 years, I had this this feeling of restlessness that the propositions that we were taking as a consulting company to our clients were not delivering the right value, and that kept on becoming bigger and bigger, and that kind of was one of the biggest reasons of me quitting the corporate world and starting my own business. This happened around a couple of years back when I started blueprinting Atomex Digital. And what we wanted to do was we wanted to correct, bring back some of the ethos and the ethics of consulting model in terms of delivering large transformation programs on time, on budget, and on quality. I'd seen so many large technology-led changes not delivering the promise that they started with. So that's where the seed for Atomex Digital started from.
Okay. So what you said that you wanted to change, perspectives. You saw drawbacks into how the operation of day to day and projects and presentations and all that stuff that was happening in the bigger digital agencies. And you want to change that. So that's why the hence you created Atomex Digital. Can you tell us a little bit about what separates you in terms of what did you stop doing in terms of, some practices? It's up to you to decide how much you want to say, of course. But what differs you? I see that you are focused on digital and AI and, scale and all that stuff. So can you tell us a little bit more of that?
Sure. No, absolutely. So what we did was, right, in terms of bringing some of the corrections into our delivery model, we attach our any work that we do with a business outcome very simply to a customer experience or better customer engagement or the better newer revenue streams or an operational efficiency. So that's one thing that we are very passionate about, right, for our clients, that any work we do is related directly to a business outcome, which is typically 400 to 500% ROI. We don't believe in large teams, so one of the other key principles of Atomex is small specialist teams. Anybody who when we put together a team, anybody who's on the team is bringing something concrete of value to the end client. So we're cutting down the management oversight noise is what I call it, in the delivery teams, and we share the risk with our clients, right? So we as part of our relationship with our clients, we put a part of our fee to their success, to their KPIs, whatever it would be. Again, linking it back to the business outcomes that we talked about.
So what are some of the things that you do normally for the customers in terms of services and specific, or is it specific to each company, each problem? Do you focus on all kinds of digital services or?
No, we are quite focused on four key industries. So we work with cruise lines, airlines, airports, and commercial shipping.
Okay.
And we are very focused in what we deliver in terms of our propositions. I'll take an example of a large UK based cruise line. It's a global cruise line, but we are working with the UK arm. They have two famous brands in the UK, and we are working with them to deliver a number of solutions for their guests, for their crew, and for their partners. The way we look at the cruise industry is, for example, we look at those three key stakeholders in their ecosystem. For their guests, we are delivering a number of automation solutions. So, if I don't know whether you have been on a cruise or not, but right now there are a lot of manual processes which happen. So for example, if you have to access your bill, or if you want to understand what your travel itinerary is, or what's there for the meal, what's there for evening entertainment, all of this is extremely manual. So you walk down to a particular deck, go to the reception, talk and queue up because there are other people in there as well, and then talk to one of the crew members, and they will give you a kind of an analog printout of your latest bill. We have automated all of that and made it available through various digital channels, one of them being app, wherein you have a digital assistant. It's almost like talking to your bill. So mm-hmm. so you can inquire the bill about, so tell me about my latest spend. I don't really recognize that 60 quid spend that's showing over there. Can you give me more detail about that, etc. Give me a trigger if my son spends more than 30 quid in casino, for example.
Yeah.
So what that does is that it on one side it makes the customer experience better, so it engages the customer more. It reduces the burden on the crew. So on a high level, we created a business case, and we are saving our client between £5 to £7 million over their 10 ships over 1 year, just due to one use case of this bill bot, is what we call it. And you can extend the same philosophy or same proposition into entertainment, into travel desk, etc. It becomes more and more interesting when you take it to a travel desk on excursions, because if somebody is interested in understanding, okay, fine, we are going to dock in Barcelona in 6 hours. I want to understand what are the excursion options over there. All the cruise companies, they have partnerships with the local port companies for various activities that people can do on the port. And we are bringing that ecosystem into the ship, right? So somebody wants to understand what kids' entertainment options are, or what are the good places to eat. They will get a promotion from one of the partners of the cruise line, mm-hmm. and that opens up a new kind of ancillary revenue stream for our clients. So that way, it's kind of creating value across the three or four stakeholders ecosystem, and then distributing it to each and every member of that ecosystem. If you like, that's what we are doing.
So pretty much you're building up the system from the ground up. So it's everything is customized, or how
does it work? We have off the shelf products. We partner with a number of specialist AI companies. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was going back to Atomic's philosophy of specialization and small teams. When I started Atomic's, we basically went into the market of AI, talked to a number of AI agencies and AI product companies, and selected some of the partners who are there displayed on our website as well, who do something really well. So somebody is doing machine learning really well. They do any kind of machine learning. You give them data, they'll come up with really good insights and predictive analytics. Somebody is doing good chatbots, etc. We stitch all of that together into a particular solution and take that to our clients.
So it's a little bit of a systems and sales, and at the same time it's IT, which is something that needs to be stitched together and, you know, focused and not custom made, but custom put together, custom built for the purposes of the client.
Correct. And over the course of last 6 or 7 months, what we have found out is that there is a lot of similarity among the industries that we work in, right? So the industries that we have chosen are not by chance, they're by design, because our specialization is in remote enterprises, places where internet is not very readily available, mm-hmm. right? So if you think about the world as of now, right, and where the innovation is happening, most of the innovation and new products and services are happening in the cloud. That by definition leaves those industries out which don't have good access to the cloud, i.e. through a good broadband or internet solution.
Yeah, absolutely.
And these are the industries that I talked about, shipping and airlines and mining and all those, right? So our solution or our kind of off-the-shelf offerings that we have, they are 70% more efficient when you use internet or satellite. They work on edge computing is the terminology that we use, which is that they bring the intelligence to the edge as opposed to the cloud. So in a ship scenario, our intelligence will sit in the ship on the ship server as opposed to in the cloud in one of the data centers. In an airline scenario, it sits either on people's handsets, i.e. the mobiles, or if there's a server available on the airline, on the aircraft itself, it sits there. And it makes that intelligent kind of conversations with the client. So that is what differentiates us quite significantly in terms of edge computing and 70% data efficient over internet for any transaction. So for example, if you are purchasing an excursion, you have to go through internet. And in that situation, we are 70% more efficient than anybody else in the market.
Wow. Those are some great statistics. And it's I guess it's super interesting because you have a couple of clients, I guess, you're not focused on tens of hundreds of clients. You got really specific, but you're so deep into the relationship with them and, you know, building partnerships and building the whole solution across, you know, like you said, 10 ships and, you know, different little specifics of, let's say, you know, booking food, checking expenses, and everything in terms of, you know, automation and, you know, creating the solution for the specifics.
Exactly. And again, kind of coming back to the cruise industry, excuse me. One of the, like, if you think about the cruise industry, it's not as kind of forward as some of the other industries like telco and media, etc. They're still kind of gearing up. And if you go to airlines industry, there's a highly regulated industry for the right reasons. So they're kind of still gearing up for internet and internet related propositions. So what we are also doing is we are bringing our clients on their journey to be able to kind of deliver change properly, right? Hitting it hard from an ROI perspective, because looking at cruises, they're like around 50 cruises of big ships which are being purchased across the world between now and 2022. And each cruise or each ship costs around $1 billion. So that's the kind of investment which is going on. However, the cruise line, like the companies, they're not willing to increase the number of crew. So right now, the proportion of crew versus guests on a large ship is around 1,300 to 1,400 versus 3,000. In a large ship, it will be same 1,300 people trying to serve 5,000 people. So you can imagine the amount of automation which needs to happen both on the kind of guest side and the crew side. And that is where we are hitting it hard. So we are going to the core of our potential clients and saying that we can actually help you deliver your strategy at speed and with certainty, because we have off-the-shelf solutions which are super efficient.
Well, definitely sounds like some people say they don't like the term disrupting the industry, but I guess you're doing it in your own, you know, specific way. So what about let's say context in terms of the actual builders of the ships. Can you make like a partnership with those, or have you, are you doing that in the moment or anything like that?
Yes, from a kind of go-to-market strategy, right? We are partnering with the aggregators as well, if you like. So, so we are also working quite heavily in commercial shipping, for example, which is a completely different ball game to a cruise industry. The cruise industry is, I would say, a rich industry. They don't have an issue of demand. Most of the cruises are more than 100% subscribed, etc. Whereas the commercial shipping industry are extremely low margin, high asset industry. So a little bit of a turbulence in the sea, and suddenly their margin goes down to negative, and they have to burn, because they have to burn more fuel. That's how flaky it is. So there we have to be even sharper in terms of what our propositions are. In there, we are working with a number of kind of service providers who provide global like navigation systems, charting solutions, etc., to the commercial shipping industry. What that gives us is a scale. So, for example, we are working with a service provider which has around 13.5 thousand vessels floating around in the world, where they have their own navigation solutions on those ships. And we are delivering a voice calling solution which reduces the current shore to ship calling from around $6.4 to $2.8.
Wow.
Because of our kind of our partnerships with the satellite providers, the way we route the call through VoIP, etc. So that gives a direct bottom line advantage to the end customer, and that's delightful for them, because that is what they're looking for. They can't have a massive revenue uplift, but they can definitely operate better in terms of efficiencies. And it gives us scale, because once we have integrated with the service provider, our solution can be deployed in a SaaS mode across 13.5 ships. So suddenly we get scale as well. Not to say that we are going directly to the shipping companies as well, just to kind of hedge our bets. But we are working with the service providers as well. So it depends on the industry that you are in. You have to customize your go-to-market strategy, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely sounds like you're in the right place, and you've built up that, you know, that momentum. If we go a couple of steps back, what was like some of the hardest things you have to do once you started up the Atomex? In terms of, you probably have some people that you already know in the industries from your previous, jobs. What were some of the struggles? Because from what I've been hearing, it sounds pretty great right now. I guess it's not. I mean, every business day to day is, you know, always struggles and always something that can be done, and, you know, nerves and everything like that. But just to step back in the beginning of the company, what was something that you were struggling to build up, or you're facing, or something like that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, all entrepreneurs, they face a sunshine scenario and a doom scenario almost on a daily or weekly basis.
Yeah.
And that just comes with the role, I guess, or with the job. And when we started, in fact, we had quite an interesting journey, because we wanted to be a digital and AI agency, period. And we wanted to be industry agnostic, because we believed that the value that we were bringing in by the three pillars that I explained earlier was quite immense in terms of people contracting with us. And very soon, quite soon actually, after our research and our interactions in a network, we found that we were kind of competing almost directly with the big boys, with the big boys of the industry, and we were trying to make something better as opposed to making something new, right? And there's always a challenge in making people realize that the value that you're adding is way more, is quite high. Whereas if there's a clear need and a gap, and you're just going and filling that need and gap, it's the value is very obvious there.
Yeah.
So that was one thing that we discovered very, very, very quickly. And that's when we moved slightly the North Star from a generic digital transformation agency to an AI transformation agency, which fixes problems or relates directly to the business outcomes and works on in specific industries. So suddenly we kind of put three levels of specialization in terms of what we were bringing to the market. And I fundamentally believe that the next wave after digital transformation would be AI transformation. And that will be the next one, which will kind of go through the S-curve. It's, I think we are already hitting the peak of it. And it'll go on for next 5 to 7 years or 10 years, maybe, the way that digital transformation has gone. That's my belief. And if you search for AI transformation agency, we come number one in organic search. So that was the kind of the course correction that we did. On a day-to-day basis, the challenges were that of how do you get in front of someone. I never had issues, if you like, in terms of delivering a solution once somebody asked for it, because we were quite hungry. We had the right experience, skills. I had the right network. The issue was to be in front of people so that they can hear and listen to you. And once you were there, they loved it. And they loved the propositions, and it went quite fast. But just to kind of get into the door for the first time was the biggest challenge, single biggest challenge that I faced. And that's one of the things that we still kind of put a lot of emphasis on. And when I advise like the new startups or other network people, that's one thing that I always try and kind of emphasize on, that have a very strong plan of your go-to-market strategy. Because I see so many startups, frankly, who have a brilliant product, have a brilliant kind of propositions, have a clear-cut business case, but still are not able to kind of get clients on board. Simple.
Yeah, I mean, especially in today's market and everybody being, you know, on social media, and you see all those messaging, and it's so much harder to cut through the noise in terms of from the perspective of being a business owner or having a company or a startup, even though your product is amazing or great, or once they see it, they love it, or they'll buy it. If they don't know who you are, you're not in business. Simple as that.
Exactly. What I've also seen, because I work quite closely with a number of startups in terms of defining their go-to-market strategy, helping them shape it as well, is that there are a lot of companies which are in the startup world which are inward-looking, right? So they are kind of thinking about, oh, this is my great product. This is, it can do all these things. And I am 100% sure that this will work. But they haven't really market tested it. They haven't really gone out to the market for advice, for feedback, etc. Right? When they actually reach out, the proposition looks quite raw in terms of the description, how you kind of position it, and B, they might be going on a completely different track as to what they were thinking people are going to buy. So it's very important to start with where the problem is. So you may have the best solution, but frankly, my problem is something else. So great solution, but not for me. Is the scenario that you want to avoid quite early on in your journey?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's this notion of you have to have traction in order for your product to grow. And if you've only been building it for and not showing it to customers for like a couple of years or a year, or depending on your time period, it's the shock of people just not liking the product and not wanting it is why you wasted so much time. It's not only time, it's time and resources and of course money you put into it. It's some kind of a fear of, you know, your baby not being liked and something you've been working so hard for, just failing. But the sooner, I've seen it from my own life, and I've been involved in startups as well. You have that fear that you kind of know that something is wrong, but you don't want the confirmation from the customers to say exactly the same thing, because you have to change direction, but you're kind of in love with what you've been doing so far. But yeah,
otherwise actually that's you make a good point, and some of the kind of the mentoring that I have to do is to look at business as a business and not as a research or a university or an academia, where you want to do something and you want to kind of keep making it better and better. It probably doesn't have a commercial value after a while. It kind of reminds me of quite an interesting case study we did in NCR. I did my MBA from NCR in 2005-2006 in France, and we studied blue ocean strategy. Mm-hmm. And one of the case studies that we had was Cirque du Soleil. It was very fascinating and interesting, extremely relevant to the startup world. Wherein, so this guy, it was a family business, got passed on from father to son. It was a circus to start with. He inherited this circus and frankly said, I don't want to run a circus. It's not my cup of tea. What should I do? I don't want to compete with other circuses, etc. So he came up with this this kind of framework of start, stop, enhance, and reduce, right? So in terms of he got rid of all the animals, brought in music, brought in ambience, you get good drinks, this and that, when you go and attend Cirque du Soleil. He said the people are already amazed when a trapeze artist does seven somersaults. And then why do I have, three somersaults. And why do I have to pay someone through the roof to make seven somersaults? I'm okay at three. So things like that. So he corrected all that. And we call it a blue ocean. So he created a new positioning for that and created a new industry, which you can't say it's a musical. You can't say it's a circus. It's something new, right? And therefore, you almost lose your kind of competition. Completely. And that's something that I kind of took on board to find what is that blue ocean that I can create in Atomex. And I would encourage anyone in the startup world to look at it from that lens.
Yeah, I guess it's irrelevant until in all different, you know, business niches. It's 100% relevant for me as well. And you see a lot of, you know, marketing agencies, social media marketing agency, everybody's pretty much on the surface of it looking like they're doing the same thing. But you face pretty much the same problem, like you said. You're just becoming one of the same. You're in the red ocean, and everybody's the same. You cannot differentiate. And once you find, or you only actually like you search within yourself, or between your, you know, your customers, or between your partners, or whatever, for that thing that, you know, you can make it completely unique and just add it to the mix and add it to the mix, add it to the mix. And at some point, you arrive probably at your position and having a clear defined market and, you know, differentiating yourself from everybody else and just standing out in the market.
Exactly. So that was pretty interesting to try and implement that framework into Atomex.
So on a personal level, would you say that you always had that entrepreneurial spirit in you? Because you said you've been working through big companies, big brands, into the corporate world, and then at some point you wanted to start something on your own. Was there like a mental challenge? Was it something that was influencing you in terms of, you know, your family? Or was it something that it was actually inside you, like a drive, or you always knew that you had to achieve something greater than just, you know, being part of the machine and all that stuff?
That's a very interesting question. And there were different forces and different things which came together. So I spent a lot of time in a company called Sapient, as I mentioned, yeah. And joined them pretty young. The environment in Sapient was very entrepreneurial when I joined, and had quite a good relationship with their the founders, Jerry and Stu as well, and really liked their philosophy. Over the course of 6, 7 years, 8 years. Right, Sapient began to scale and started basically becoming one of the corporates, right, and that's where that kind of it's lost its touch of entrepreneurship. I was always of this kind of view that you have to give freedom to breed innovation and to bring in creativity into work. And the more process I had to follow, the less I was happy. Within perspective, obviously. So that entrepreneurial spirit was always there. In early 2000s, I worked in a number of startups as well. That was a year of Y2K and IT and stuff like that. So that was always the case. But over time, I grew more and more kind of frustrated with the kind of corporate machinery in terms of the bloated value or bloated pricing, which reduced value that was being taken to the market. And there's also this drive in the market, in the industry, or the clients, if you like, wherein a lot of clients are now creating their in-house teams, digital teams. They're nurturing it. They want their digital teams to be under their nose, delivering specific kind of propositions, etc. So the industry as such has kind of gone the whole circle, right? So 15, 20 years ago, outsourcing was a big deal. And now it's kind of coming back, wherein small teams under your nose in the local geography is the norm. So combining all those factors and my own kind of this thing that I had in mind that I have to do something beyond just going through the life, just working for someone else or a big company, just pushed me through it. It wasn't a very pleasant conversation to start with my family, because where I come from, I originally belong to India, and my family is all has nobody in my family has ever done a business. Let me put it this way, right? So across all kind of brothers, sisters, cousins, and everybody is either a professor or in some corporate or a PhD, etc. So they are all kind of from that background. So when I actually introduced this thing, saying that I'm going to do this, there was a big kind of pushback from everyone. But then I had to kind of do it to just kind of because I had to do it. almost like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I had people that I know I was studying in Thailand that are from, you know, Indian culture, and I always see that hierarchical structure of the families, mm-hmm. and how everything's super patriarchal, and the father is the, you know, we have that similar thing back home in Bulgaria, but it's not, I guess, to the same extent. And always you always see people being super hungry for achievements in terms of, you know, awards, in terms of the highest possible grades, pushed through professional, the proper professions, like, you know, doctors, lawyers, everything like you said. So I guess that for you, that was something that was totally outside of the norm. And how did you manage?
Absolutely. In fact, yeah, absolutely. And that was a barrier for me. In fact, when I was growing up, I was encouraged, encouraged is a more sophisticated word, but I'll use it. I was encouraged to go into engineering, and IITs, IIT, the group of IITs in India are the most reputed kind of engineering institutes. 1% people qualify in terms of how many people apply. So I had to actually almost kind of prove a point in the family, because they were like, every second door was an IIT engineer. So you do that, satisfy a part of your family, yeah. And then you do what you have to do. It's almost like that for me. And I do feel that's like the new generation which is coming through, they probably can do better in that area. And do what you want to do from day one, I guess.
Go ahead.
Yeah, but nothing to take away from the experience that I've had before I started my own company, right? and various kind of experiences in the startups initially, then in Sapien, BA Systems, and a number of other kind of digital agencies. The clients that I worked with, quite a varied industry kind of mix, right from healthcare to telco, media, aerospace, defense, automotive. I mean, that's what you do basically when you're in a consulting mode. So all that experience is immensely valuable when I now kind of in my day-to-day life. So nothing taking away from that, but it's also a kind of propeller which pushed me into creating my own company.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can sort of relate to that whole situation that you had, because I've been starting companies, I've been starting different businesses, I'm going through my journey through life on different occasions, and up to some point you're kind of like the only one person believing in yourself, because people want to go to a safer road, and why don't you just have a normal job? Why you have to do something on your own? That whole situation. But I guess just people kind of understand up to one point to just let go and to believe in you even more than you believe in yourself, and just to see how you can continue your journey. And I'm just thinking in terms of the family and all the relationship, and I just can't relate to the pushback of why don't you just stay in the corporate job? Why are you trying to make your life harder than it can be? Why don't you just
exactly? So one of the things that you have to do as an entrepreneur is almost shut down those conversations in the initial days, or reduce those conversations and focus on what you believe is going to be the right thing. But I won't advise anybody to be too hard on themselves. It's fine to fail. It's good to fail in a way. And I've had a series of kind of failures on the way as well. You meet 10 people, 10 prospects, one goes ahead. You have failed 9 times, but you got to look at that one, which is a success. And that's how it happens in every domain. If you look at any sport as well, that's how it happens. So one of the things that you've got to kind of introspect in yourself is do you have the resilience to keep going and keep rediscovering yourself almost on a weekly basis for quite a long time, significantly long time, before things become stable and similar to how you had it in the corporate world. It's definitely not a good idea to compare it with the way that things were in the corporate world, the benefits and the compensation and all those things. But having said that, that will always play upon your mind. You've got to look at the big picture. You have to look at the long-term picture and see whether it is for you or not. And one thing that I can say is that if you are there with the kind of grit and the right kind of attitude, you will succeed eventually.
So. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I was sort of like smiling and internally laughing of like how exactly you're describing your journey was just part of my journey. And just you think you plan things to happen in like 6 months, and then it happened in 1 year, because that's how life works. You cannot force things faster than normal rules of life, let's say.
Correct.
And the resilience is definitely the word, and especially when at some point you just I just want to say it out loud, because I'm thinking, I've actually been speaking with my girlfriend as well, is the entrepreneurial journey, it's a pretty lonely place, especially if you are the owner and you have to search for everything on your own, as in the beginning. Even the people that are super close to you cannot know what you've been going through, and all the, like you said, rediscovering yourself and trying to find the layers of strength inside of you each and every week, just depending on the challenges you face.
Exactly. Yeah. So you got to have that resilience and the grit to force it through. Good things do happen. And then success starts coming in. I mean, in Atomic's journey, I've seen a massive kind of turnaround in the past 3 to 4 months. We have had clients onboarded. We have We have been mentoring large cohorts. I was in Hamburg 1.5 months back, mentoring a hackathon of around 40 people who were developing. Some of the groups were developing applications on our kind of development platform, etc. So there is a lot of recognition which starts coming through, but you need to kind of keep at it.
I guess that's the hardest part, because you get all those outside noise of, and especially when you're down and you're like not beaten up, but you know, rejected, let's say. Everything you're trying to do is, it just takes time to, you know, dust yourself off and just continue moving. But I guess there's this funny notion that I heard, I've read from Robin Sharma: if you're trying to just achieve 1% better than the previous day and just move into the same direction, it's gonna exponentially create that scale that you're trying to achieve.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm not sure. I always ask my guests of, you know, books that have helped them or people that they've been looking up to. It could be people from inside the family that you've been looking up to, or outside people, courses, anything that, you know, another person can just read, look up to, research or study, that can bring you up to your level of understanding of how the world goes and the world and the business and everything like that.
That's a good question, and it's a combination of things that has worked for me. There are definitely some very good books which one should read. There is one by Jeff Bezos about Amazon story. I really like the Amazon way of world. Very practical, extremely customer oriented, service oriented. So if somebody is in this kind of the services industry, all of us are in some kind of a service industry. So I would encourage people to kind of read the Amazon story. I'm lucky to have quite a good non-exec board who are both my friends and also my kind of proper kind of serious non-execs. So they grill me in the board meetings, and then on the dinner table they will ask me, how you doing, how are you holding up, is everything okay, how's the family, did you have a holiday, etc. So you've got to have that support on both sides. So in the boardroom they will ask me, Anand, you were saying that these three contracts are going to come. What makes you believe that one thing has been delayed for 6 weeks now? What makes you believe that's going to come this week? And things like that. Where is your kind of how you're handling culture? How are you handling your values? How are you bringing new people on board? How are you bringing new clients on board, etc. So they challenge me. They push me around, etc. And that's very healthy. Extremely healthy. So it's very important to have the right kind of people around you. Choose the right team that you want to work with. And in the past, I've had some really kind of good bosses who have given, like, taught me something really nice in their own way. So one of the chaps, I won't say his name, but he was extremely dedicated, and it almost kind of was common sense for him that, why would you not be dedicated? Why would you not do this right now as opposed to putting it? It's a very simple philosophy, but it helps me quite a lot when things kind of get tougher, right? That you just need to kind of do it. For example, I've been a coder, I've been an architect, I've been a project manager, I've been a business analyst, I've been a chief commercial officer, I've been an analyst, I've been all of those things, right? Because the reason was that there was nobody else to do those things, right? There is you walk into a workshop, you have a workshop scheduled with a client, and two of your team members are not cannot join in. You have to fill that up because you are catch-all as the owner of the business, as the MD of the business. You are catch-all for all these issues. So it's a lot about kind of the mindset, the attitude that you bring to the table, And people see that, the clients see that, that in any situation, right, you are still holding the can, you're still kind of moving it along in the right way with the right value. So to summarize, right, you should kind of, there are a number of very interesting books on leadership, on services industry, Amazon being one of them. You've got to have surrounded by good kind of people who are not just kind of the office formal group, but also your kind of friends and mentors. And you've got to have the right attitude. I have this philosophy that I don't want to hire if someone is not okay on skills, I'm okay with that. But if somebody is not okay on attitude, then that's a definite no. It's not going to go ahead. Because that's so important.
Yes, the two parts of surrounding yourself with the proper people, and especially having them being your friends and mentors in the same time, and also pushing you in terms of business, but also on a personal level and relationship with, you know, your family and everything around that is super important, because you don't see them only as a business structure and business support, but you see them as a life support, let's say. Pushing you and just having that like a funnel to, you know, say everything that you have on your mind, and just having a person that you look up to you know, respond and see, and just to see if you're on the right path in a way.
No, absolutely. And at times they bring up points which you haven't really thought about, and it's very obvious that you have missed a particular quite an important point, and it's very important. Yeah, that's the beauty of having those kind of varied, skilled people around you.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of wrapping in the conversation up, do you have anything more you want to say? Do you have anything you want to promote, or anything that you look up from the audience, or anything whatsoever?
I think there are two points that I want to bring up. One is that if somebody is thinking about getting into entrepreneurship, they need to get a buy-in from their family, from their immediate, like their wife and their kids, if they are big enough, because that support is very important, as you just said, right? And think hard. In terms of the preparation that I mentioned earlier, in terms of how do you, what will be your go-to-market strategy? Why would people buy it, etc. So do some prep before jumping into entrepreneurship is one point that I can't stress more. The other is that be ready that what you plan to do in a month might take 6 months. What you plan to do in 6 months might take 2 years. And that is just the nature of the work here, right? And so your plans will get thrown out of the window every quarter or every month, not because you're not putting in enough effort, just because that's how the machinery works. So be ready for that when you are jumping into entrepreneurship.
Well, thank you very much for the super pleasant conversation. Like I say every time, let's hope we help at least one person get something beneficial out of the conversation. And thanks again for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.